If you want to turn in your Bibles, you can turn your Bibles to Genesis chapter 11. This is not going to be a read the story of Abraham week. On Tuesday, I sat down to start. I'd already had some notes. I've been thinking about this one for a while. And I sat down and was like, well, you know, I ought to read the whole story of Abraham just to refamiliarize myself with the story. It's 10 chapters, so you should get real comfortable. It basically, if I read it to you, then that would be our sermon and we'd go home for the morning. So if you want to read the Abraham story, you can read that. If you want to prepare for next week, we are specifically, there's not a lot of text given to Isaac. So we're just next week going to talk about Abraham sacrificing or not sacrificing Isaac. We're just going to talk about that one story next week. So if you want to read ahead, I'll point you to where that is in a minute here when we get there. But I want to talk about the story of Abraham, and what I'm going to do for a couple minutes is give you an outline of the big story, of all the little stories that make up the big story, the meta-narrative, and then we're going to talk about why does this whole collection of stories exist, not so much the individual ones, because there's lots of them in here, and we're not going to get into each and every one. This is the first story, by the way. This is the significance, is all the other stories we've done, the two creation stories, the flood narrative, the story of Babel, Job, all those stories we've done so far have been kind of like that. They're more mythical, the beginnings of humankind, like really up here. This is the first story where the Hebrews are telling their story. This is why we are who we are, and we're not the Moabites, and we're not the Ammonites, and we're not the whoever. We're not all these other people. We're not the Egyptians. We're not the Sumerians. We are who we are, and it starts with Abraham. And so this is kind of a turn in the text, and that's this part of the significance here. So let's just, let me do this first to warm you all up. Tell me favorite stories of Abraham or the stories that you remember off the top of your head or what you know about Abraham. Let's do it real quickly. Parting of the sea? No, that's Moses. It's cold. That's fine. Although you're from Minnesota, you have no excuse. Father Abraham had many sons. Many sons had Father Abraham. And I am one of them, and so are you. So let's just praise the Lord. Right arm. I've never understood why this had anything to do with Father Abraham. But it was so fun. The only part of that song that made sense is the last part where it was turn around and sit down. I understood why my children's church teachers had that part in there, but I didn't understand why the swinging arms, except that it was a lot of fun. Yeah. Yeah, go to a land, chapter 12, go to a land that I will show you and I will make you a blessing to all nations. We've talked about that one a lot in here. Any other Abraham stories? Covenant. Which one? Yes, good. We're going to hit that one briefly just in a minute. Yeah. Moses. That's all right. No, I'm fascinated. This is great. We're conflating Moses and Abraham. It's good. Bargaining with God for Sodom and Gomorrah. We're going to see that one here in just a minute. Oh, yeah. So there's this arc that goes throughout that Abrahamic story about I'm going to make you a great nation and your wife is barren. And so the patience required. Yeah. Married to his sister. Yeah, there's that. And then at various times, plays her off as his wife, and then other times it's more convenient to say, oh, she's my sister, and gets him into trouble repeatedly. But blessed a lot. Yes, we're going to get to that in just a minute. Yes, good. Yeah, so this is the story, what I said just a minute ago about how it splits out, this story is the split. So if we had Muslims in our midst, we could talk about Babel, flood, all those things. It's in the Abraham story that Ishmael was born and we get the split off where Muslims take a turn out of the Hebrew text and have their own thing. Yeah, good. He was asked for the sacrifice, yeah. Yeah, we're going to dig into that one next week because I think a lot of us have issues with that one, right? About he was asked to sacrifice his son and Abraham's response was, my only son? Sure, that one? Yeah, I'll do that. Yeah. The Handmaid's Tale. I haven't read that nor seen it. Oh, Hagar, the connection to Hagar. Yes, that's a big story that Jeff Agin has taught here a couple times. All right. So let's put all of these in context and separate out Abraham and Moses and get where we're at, all right? So we all kind of have a big overview of Abraham. Because I realize that I had an education where my fourth grade spelling list was the books of the Bible. Anyone else? Yeah, three of us. Four. I'm sure Jennifer, too. There's like four of us in the room that my fourth grade spelling test was literally the books of the Bible. That is not a joke. I'm not making that up, all right? So this stuff is like the air I breathed growing up, and I realize it's maybe not that clear for everyone else. So if you want to just kind of flip through your Bible as we're going, you can, but I'm just going to summarize 10 chapters in about 10 minutes, okay? So the first mention of Abraham, or Abram as he was called then, is in chapter 11, verse 31. Terah's a guy's name here, by the way. Terah took his son Abram, his grandson Lot, Haran's son, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and set out with them from Ur of the Chaldees for the land of Canaan. But when they got as far as Haran, they got tired and they settled down there. The tired part is what I added. Terah lived 205 years. He died in Haran. Chapter 12. All right. Well, so let's start there. So Abram's father, Terah, moves from Ur to Haran. This is a journey of a couple hundred miles at least. Now, let's take a second and think about travel in this time period, all right? How many of you, Central Illinois is not your home? So about half of you. How many of you have moved in the last 10 years? Last 5 years? Yeah, so at least still a third of the church has moved in the last five years. We don't think that moving somewhere is that big of a deal, right? It's not. Maybe you've had conversations this week or this month or even the last couple months about, hey, I don't know, maybe we should move. Maybe we should live here. Maybe we should live there. Maybe someday I want to live somewhere else. Or maybe you say, I hope to die in Peoria. You might. You're going to die somewhere. I mean, it's fine. So when we think about travel, and when we think about traveling even just for vacation 1,000 miles, how do we think about it? Like, no big deal, right? It is no big deal to go somewhere. So 1,000 miles from here, roughly, is Denver, Colorado. It's 950 miles from my parents' doorstep in Glassford to the doorstep of our apartment in Denver. We don't think two thoughts about doing that kind of a trip, right? So when we read this sometimes, it's easy for us to say like, oh, they uprooted everything and they moved. It's a bit anachronistic for us to think back and think that's not a big deal, because for them to move is massive. You will never talk to the people that you're leaving. You will never talk to these people again. There's no email. There's no phone. There's no communication over hundreds of miles, especially back in Abraham's time. By Roman time, maybe now you can get letters and things, but Abraham's time, it's leaving. So think about that right now. When we talk about Terah moving from Ur to Haran, think about moving from here to Denver on foot with your family, meaning your immediate family and your in-laws, all right? So let's say 30, 40 people, all of you moving on foot to Denver start today, and every part of your life from here, you won't, none of that goes with you, except the people that are going with you, all right? Does that seem scary? Maybe for some of you, you're like, oh, that would be awesome. But for most of us, that feels a little bit intimidating, that everything that you know of this life, your occupation, your ancestors, your tribe, everything you know, you're walking away from, literally walking away from, and it's going to take you years and years and years to travel 1,000 miles at the clip of a couple miles a day, because you have to eat and live and all that stuff while you're going. So Abraham's father, Terah, moves from, we don't know what compels Terah to move. He's the one that first sets out for Canaan, but he along the way, by the way, another anachronism in the text, it wasn't called Canaan then, it was just this land somewhere. They're reading back in the text, but Terah starts the journey. And then chapter 12, we get our introduction then to God's call on Abraham. So God told Abram, leave your country, your family, your father's home for a land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation and bless you. I'll make you famous. You'll be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you. Curse those you curse. All the families of the earth will be blessed through you. So roughly, just for you that are geographically inclined, here's the basic progression. Ur is way down in the bottom right. Ur, Babylon, Mari. Haran is way up at the top. So he's basically traveling the whole Fertile Crescent, all the way up and around, then down. And he's going to keep going. We're going to see in the next chapter. He goes all the way down to Egypt and then back through the Negev, back up to Canaan. Then he's going to do a little bit of traveling in there. And then just so we can put this in the bigger story, eventually His grandson Jacob moves the whole tribe back down to Egypt. They come back through the Sinai Peninsula, and they just keep moving all around in there. All right? So, chapter 13. So we got Abraham moved. I raced through a slide. So chapter 12 is Abraham leaves Haran, goes all the way down to the Negev, then to Egypt. Chapter 13, Abraham and his nephew Lot separate. Do you remember this story? If you were a flannel graph kid, anybody flannel graph kids? Just so I know. Okay, that's better than the spelling test. So about a third of us. Lot is Abraham's nephew traveling with him. They get such herds when they go into, I need to say one thing about Egypt. Can I say one thing about Egypt? When they go to Egypt, this is the first place where Abram is afraid. Apparently Sarai is a hottie. And he's afraid that when the ruler there sees his wife, that she's going to be taken from him because she's beautiful. So he's like, yeah, she's my sister, which I don't think is a very good strategy up front. So then when the Pharaoh realizes that, he's his wife, the Pharaoh says, like, you've done a bad thing to me, so here's your wife back, and here's a lot of animals and gold. I'm going to make you really rich for this. Just go away. Which seems like something nobody has ever done in history, right? Like, the most logical thing to do would be to do what? Kill him. Like, come on, like, despot 101. You take his wife and you find out it's his wife, you kill the dude and it's all over with. But instead he gives him Lot's stuff. So he comes back from Egypt very wealthy, he and Lot both, and so they can't be on the same grazing land and they split. Do you remember this story where Abram says, hey, choose whatever you want, and Lot's like, well, I'm going to choose it's like my kids choosing, you know, which ice cream they're going to take. There's only one factor involved. Which one's the biggest? Yeah, I'm just going to take the biggest one. And Lot does the same thing. Like, well, that land's nicer. If you're going to give me the choice, I'll take it. Thanks. And so Abraham doesn't choose his, takes the rest. Chapter 14, Lot is attacked by these five kings that ally themselves against Lot. Lot settles in the area of Sodom and Gomorrah. Five kings come up against Lot and Abram, attack them, take Lot off into captivity. Abram puts together a set of kings. They go to war. He rescues Lot. Yay, yay, yay. Chapter 15, God and Abram make a covenant that Danny talked about. So God comes back to Abram at this time still, and says, hey, listen, I'm going to bless you. I want to remind you of what I said to you way back up in Haran. I want to remind you that I'm going to bless you. And to do that, we're going to basically sign a contract with each other. So in our day today, when we go to make a contract with somebody, what do? You go somewhere and you sign. You probably have lawyers draw up papers. You sign things. You file it. Yada, yada. What they did is they didn't have lawyers. They didn't have contracts. What they did instead is if you were going to make a contract with somebody, you would get these animals together, certain prescribed animals. You would cut the animals in half. You would lay the halves on either side of the aisle. So it'd be like half a goat here, half a goat here, half a chicken here, half a chicken here. And then you would make your deal, and then you would walk together through the animals, and you would say, may I become like one of these animals if I don't fulfill my end of the deal? Which is pretty serious stuff, right? What's fascinating and what would be a really great sermon to do sometime, is in this contract, if you get down to the bottom of it, I have this scripture up on screen here. Verse 17, when the sun was down and it was dark, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch moved between the split carcasses. That's when God made a covenant with Abram. Danny, what did you notice about that? What's significantly missing in this version, in what happens here? Yeah. It's like making a business deal with somebody and they say, like, I'll sign it. You don't have to sign. I've got it. That's what's happening here. So there's these two narratives always happening in the Hebrew scriptures, which this is another sermon someday. There's these two narratives always. The one says, if you do X, then I'll do Y. So in Genesis, remember what I just read a couple minutes ago? If you follow me, Abram, I will make you a great nation. Like, there's this conditional thing going on. And then there's this other thread of there's no conditions. There's no conditions to this. I'm going to make a contract with you, and I'm the only one that's going to sign. Like, it's just going to be based on my faithfulness to you. It's just going to be based on my goodness. And so, reaffirmation of the covenant. Chapter 16, Sarai is getting older, and And she's like, I haven't had a baby yet. I'm not sure if I can ever have a baby. So why don't you, here's my most trusted servant. Why don't you have a baby with her and it'll be the same? Which doesn't feel like the same thing at all. I don't know about any of you all. It doesn't feel qualitatively like the same thing. But that's what happens. And we get the Hagar story, which is really good. Chapter 17, we get a reestablishment of the covenant again, except this time, this is that other thread where God says, Abram, I want to know that you're serious about this covenant. So to show me that you're serious, I'm going to need you to do a minor procedure. Now, in our culture, that's done within the first 24, 48 hours, you know, like no big deal. They say that many of the little boys that have that procedure just go to sleep. I think it was like, that's fine. Abraham's a grown man. And God comes to him, like, I just want you to pause for a second and think about circumcision, not specifically about circumcision, but rather how serious Abraham is about this covenant. I want you to imagine if there's anything that we could come along and say to you, if God said, I'm so serious with it about this that I want you to pierce your ear with an ice pick, which, by the way, doesn't feel as serious as circumcision, right? How many of you today? I mean, I was just thinking, reflecting as I was reading this, like, this is a really big deal. And so the text ends with, yeah, Abraham circumcised himself, which, yeah. And then he circumcised his whole household. So all the males of a certain age got circumcised. You can read all about it in Genesis chapter 17. Genesis 18, three visitors show up to Abraham's tent. Abraham gets his name changed. We're told that his name now means the father of many. He had many sons. Father Abraham, we get that. Chapter 18, three visitors show up at his tent. They reaffirm the covenant. This is the one, remember what Sarah's response is when they start telling, like, hey, she's going to have a baby? She laughs, and they call, it's a great thing because one of the three visitors is like, hey, I heard you laughing. And her response, do you remember this? I wasn't laughing. It's awesome. It's just fun reading, by the way. And again, I'll just keep telling you, if you've only read this like in King James Version growing up, you really just need to get a copy of the Message and read it in the Message. It's so much better reading and so much more fun. And then the visitors, and the visitors are fuzzy, whether they're angels or men, or maybe one is a pre-incarnate Jesus, I've been taught. But then Abraham and one of the men start to negotiate for Sodom and Gomorrah. And he starts off with, the visitor says, God is going to destroy, I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah because of their wickedness. And Abraham's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. My nephew Lot lives in Sodom and Gomorrah. So if I get you 50 righteous people, you spare the city. And the visitor's like, sure. And I love this story, by the way, because I can imagine then Abraham like feeling really good about himself, like, sweet, I got him to 50. Hey, let's talk. What if I get 40 people? And so they just keep doing this back and forth. And then Abraham keeps figuring out, and they finally, remember the number they finally land on? If I can land at 10, if I could just get 10 people that are righteous, and the visitor agrees. Turn the page, we get Sodom and Gomorrah story. Dun, 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 we didn't get 10. And so you can, I'm not going to go into this story. We've talked about it here at various times about the story, except that it's a really, it's bizarre and it's rooted in ancient custom. Historians believe there may have been an earthquake or a volcano or all kinds of things here. The visitors go into the city. The men of the city come to Lot late at night and say, bring the men out so that we can have sex with them. Lot responds with, well, you can't do that, but here's my virgin daughter. Which again, I don't understand why this is a solution to the problem. Seems like an equally bad situation. And then God ends up destroying the city. And we're told throughout scripture that the sin that they had here, the juxtaposition of these two chapters, by the way, is brilliant. Because you have in one story, Abraham welcoming three visitors. And in the next story, you have the city wants to take these men, these visitors out and rape them. And the juxtaposition of those two things, we're told in the prophets that that's what God was so angry at Sodom and Gomorrah for, is their complete and utter inhospitality to the stranger. And then I'm almost done with this part, and then we'll get to the bigger part. Chapter 20, Abraham then moves again, and he moves down to the area that I think we know now is, well, we will know at the Bible times as Philistia. He encounters a king called Abimelech, and he has this thought to himself, my wife is really beautiful, and So I'm going to tell Abimelech she's my sister. And that whole story happens again, where Abimelech then finds out and gets mad. They make a covenant. And then we get to chapter 21, where, voila, Sarah eventually has their son Isaac, and they have a baby. And we're going to jump right in there next week. So if you want to read ahead for next week, we're going to pick up right at chapter 21, okay? So the question is, as I've just spent all this time rehashing the story, why does this collection of stories exist? I'm just curious. What maybe just big picture. What are some of the things that you've thought before? Like, why do these stories exist? Why are they important? How do, if you think about all of them collectively and not just any one story, why do they matter? Right, so what Ted is saying is that if you compare this to like the Sumerian religions, who we are as a people kind of came up this fuzzy mythical past where this great dragon god spit out of his mouth the waters or whatever, you know? And this story, the Hebrews, when they tell their story, are tying it to a very specific person. And even liberal scholars who doubt the veracity of the specific stories still say this is a story rooted in a land and a time and a place, and it's very specific. Similar to Islam, kind of the same, very specific. This is the story. We come from these people. Good. That's really good, Ted. Thank you. Yeah, one more. Yes. That's good. So many of us, I'm going to repeat part of what Danny said. So many of us, when we meet somebody new, what do we ask? Who are you? What do you do? We get there right away. Or if they don't ask, we tell them right away, this is what I do. And so much of our identity is derived in what we do. And in ancient cultures, that's not how they think. They're more interested in who's your tribe. Where are you from? What city, what place, what people are you from? And so the Hebrews are, that's part of why they're doing these stories, is they want you to understand these are the people we are, and the character of who we are as a people are found in these stories, which is a great transition to why I think these stories really, really matter. If you go to chapter 12, this is up on the screen, but you can look at it in your own Bible if you want. Chapter 12, verse 8. This is when he initially moves down from Haran down to the Negev and then down to Egypt. It says this, he moved on from there to the hill country east of Bethel and pitched his tent between Bethel to the west and Ai to the east. Pitched his tent. Does anybody remember when the days of YouTube were young and there was that pastor who screwed up, pitched his tent? Remember this guy? He said the word tent as tint, first of all, because he was Southern. And then he said the word pitched as pinched. And then it got really ugly. And then he got the giggles in front of his church and then just giggled a lot. And I think he single-handedly started YouTube. He built an altar there and prayed to God. Abram, this line, Abram kept moving, steadily making his way south to the Negev. Then a famine came to the land, and Abraham went down to Egypt to live. This idea, okay, so I want to start where Danny talked about, is if Israel is going to find their identity in their ancestors, then part of this story for them of who we are as a people is rooted in this, in Abraham. That this story of Abraham, if you just sit down and read all 10 chapters, you get this sense that Abraham just keeps moving. There is no destination. And I want to remind you that they're writing this in captivity, right? They're putting these stories together in Babylon where they don't have a home. So they're saying that our story is not one that, as much as we're going to talk about promised land, our story is not one about staying at home. Our story is a story always about a journey. It's about moving from this place to the next. And so for me, when I start asking why does this story matter, what comes to me the most is that spirituality is always, 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 it's a journey. And Israel sees themselves in those terms. They see themselves as on a journey. They see themselves as moving, as evolving, as becoming, as growing. And that is their, that's still their history. And it's part of their identity then. This then is the difference to me between religion and true spirituality. I tell people sometimes, like, I'm not real big on religion, which is really ironic given that I'm the pastor of a church. Whereas religion seems to be about arrival and destination and here's who we are and here's who's in and out. That's what I think of when I think of religion, is who's in and out, who's part of our thing, that thing, versus true spirituality where it's always a journey. We're always moving. We're always growing. We're always becoming. That's, to me, the story of Abram. So do you guys know Joseph Campbell? Joseph Campbell is responsible for the monomyth, the hero's journey language. If you've seen Star Wars, you know the work of Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell is completely behind the first Star Wars movie. It almost follows the hero's journey. What he says, what Joseph Campbell says, is that throughout ancient literature, there's always this narrative, and not just ancient literature, throughout literature, there's this narrative always of the hero going on a journey. Without that narrative, stories just aren't that much fun. And you can just start thinking, when you start understanding his progression of what the hero's journey looks like, you start seeing it all over the place in all the movies and all the books and all the stories that we tell. And so this idea, he says, if you can see your path laid out in front of you step by step, you know it's not your path. Your own path you make with every step you take. That is why it's your path. He's really big on journeying. And so every story then starts with the hero leaving home, right? So if you're Luke Skywalker and you're leaving home, it looks like the stormtroopers just burnt down your house and killed Uncle Beru and Aunt, oh, Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru. I always confuse them. I had an uncle, never mind, Uncle Gene and Aunt Joe. Equally confusing, Uncle Gene and Aunt Joe. I always couldn't remember who was uncle and who was aunt, Joe or Gene. And Owen and Beru do the same for me. And that has nothing to do with anything remotely church. Yep. Frodo, Bilbo, they have to leave the Shire. Whatever the stories that you love, Neo had to wake up and leave the Matrix. Whatever stories you love, Harry Potter had to leave Privet Lane. Well, I'm going to finish my sentence eventually without interrupting myself. Whatever stories you love, they always start with leaving home. They always start with a journey. The stories are about journey. And yet there's something in us that fears the journey, right? Like that makes some of us, when I started talking about like move everything you own, some of us started hyperventilating. Like, oh my gosh, I can't imagine leaving what I know and moving on. And so this spiritual journey is always one of leaving home, of leaving what is comfortable, what is known, and what one is sure of. Listen, I want to say real quick, for some of you, that journey might be geography. I'm in a profession where many of my fellow pastors, that journey for them of leaving home is always a journey of like, oh, it's time to leave home and move on to the next church. It's time for me to I just had a friend here in Peoria who just moved to Hershey, Pennsylvania, which where I hear Halloween is awesome, as it should be if you live in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And they have Halloween on the first Thursday before Thanksgiving. It doesn't matter. This has nothing to do with Peoria. So some of us, it's a geography, but I would say more often it's not a geography. It's leaving behind a way of thinking. It's leaving the home of a habit. It's leaving home of something that I've always done it this way. And the spiritual journey is always one of leaving home. It's always one of moving on in the journey. But there's powerful forces that keep us at home, right? There's just real, what keeps us from going on journeys? Real quick, you say your list and then I'll give you mine. Fear, uncertainty, resources, family, comfort. Man, I think you just hit my whole list. The things that keep us home, comfort, like ding, 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 right? I was listening to a podcast this week and I heard this guy, I love this terminology. He talked about hedonistic adaptation. Hedonistic adaptation is this. How many of us have said at some point like, boy, I just need a cup of coffee in the morning, right? Just reminded me I was thirsty. Do you really need a cup of coffee? Did you? Yes. But you didn't always need a cup of coffee. And hedonistic adaptation is this idea that something we didn't used to need, something that was once a pleasure, becomes something that we have to have now. I have to have this, and I have to have this, and I can't sleep without my bed. I have to have my bed. Do you know your ancestors for thousands of years were sleeping on ground in various places? You as a human being can adapt to that. And hedonistic adaptation is, I think, an important idea for all of us Americans to really, when we start thinking about journey, one of the first things that's going to come to mind for us is, but what about my comfortable lifestyle? What about the things I want and I like that are comfortable to me and make me feel like I need them? And part of this journey is always going to be a challenge to us to let go of things that we think we need.
And not one of us in this room is exempt from that, right? It's easy to point at somebody. It's easy for you non-coffee drinkers to point at all the coffee drinkers and be like, that is so lame that you say you need coffee in the morning. But give us a little bit of time to get to know you and we'll find your thing. Right? I need to have a very particular brand of cereal in the morning or I can't function. I need to have a particular kind of car because I will not be seen driving that kind of car. I have to have this. Anything that we say like I have to have that isn't like food, love, nutrients, water, like anything beyond that, it might. I'm not saying always. I'm not saying go give everything away. I'm just saying it might get in the way of us pursuing the spiritual journey that we're on. Fear. Somebody said fear. How many of you, just your first response is fear? Like you hear, hey, let's go on a journey, and your first response is fear. Even if I say the journey is to the other side of Peoria, just instinctively fear, right? That's just it for some of us, and I get that. Some of us just need to name it. Sometimes it's just sloth. We just don't want to go. That whole Abraham thing sounds like a lot of work to get all your tribe together and like start. It's just easier to stay here. It's not even so much about the comfort, and I'm not really afraid. That just sounds like a lot of work, and good luck with that, right? We laugh about those things. By the way, I just a little tie-in for some of you. I think Enneagram ties into all these. Like, some of these speak to me, and some I don't get. Like, for me, fear is not usually, unless it's fear of failure, if you don't finish that with fear of failure, I don't get afraid about that kind of stuff. But, oh my gosh, comfort. And some days the sloth, right? Like, it just hits me. And I know some of you in the room, by the way, just reading your faces in the last 3 minutes, some of you have really resonated with one of those things that, oh, that's the thing that keeps me from going on the journey. And so maybe this morning, the first step is just to identify and own that, right? That whatever you think it's in you to do, just to own, like, that's what it is. That's the thing that holds me back. So here's what I want to say about leaving home. Before you sign up and like, yes, I'm in for that, I want to just say for you, like, here's the warnings about what the road looks like. I just want to say up front that leaving home is just really, really hard. We joke about it, but it's true. Like when Jennifer and I got married in May, and then in August we moved to Denver, Colorado. And for us, for one of us, moving was maybe harder than the other one. And one of us might have cried from Morton to the Iowa border. And it's easy to look back at those times. It's easy to look back at those times and be like, boy, here's what I love. All right, Jennifer and I laugh. Like when my mom talks about having babies, I love my mom. But when she talks about having babies, apparently pregnancy for her was like dancing through the daisies, and it was beautiful and lovely. And the times that we were little kids, the sun just shone brighter and everything was good, right? We all do this thing. We will do it when we're grandparents, right? We will forget the sleepless nights and the diapers and all those things. All that stuff, somehow, this is why people have second children. Because I swear, I watched it the first time and I thought, there's no way she's gonna wanna do this again, right? How many of you have thought that? There is no way I'm going through this experience again. And then you did. Many of you did, right? Because we have this hindsight bias where we clean up the details. And so, like, we love to tell the story about how when we were in seminary, we couldn't do anything. We had no money to do anything. And her grandma sent us like $20 to go out on a date. So our date that night, or maybe it was less, our date literally was, we went to, there was a drive-in, like a mile or two from the seminary. We went to a double feature drive-in. We made our own carrot cake and lemonade, I think. Is that what we had? And popcorn. And right now I look back at it as like, boy, we were so simple then. It was so simple for us to, like, that was great. Like, we can't go anywhere to eat without it costing at least $50 these days, right? But what's that? No, I'm just talking about the two of us. We don't take those heathens anywhere. Pay for themselves. Oh, wait, one of them's in here. Shoot. Thought they were all gone. Listen, the journey's not going to be easy. I'm sure for Abraham, this journey wasn't just like, hey, let's just roll on down to Canaan. It was hard. I mean, literally in the story, if you take it super literally, we understand. Like, there was times where he thought he was going to die. Where if I move there and I
they're going to kill me because of my wife. Not only is it hard, but it's lonely. I'm going to say the other side of this in a minute. But there's a loneliness to stepping out. Brené Brown, in her new book, Braving the Wilderness, which I'm going to quote from in just a minute, talks about there's a loneliness to stepping out into the wilderness. Because whatever your journey is, you're going to be stepping away. Right now, you're surrounded by the people who are in the same space that you are, right? And if you decide to move, listen, some of you are in this church because there was a time where you were in a different church. And you knew that your journey was colliding with who that church was. And there came a time where you just said, like, I need to set out. And the leaving of that church was really, really painful. Because people that you loved and people that you journeyed with and people that just got you and you had the same language, they felt hurt and they felt confused and they felt lost and you felt lost and confused and hurt. And maybe now it's better, but there was a time where it was hard because the journey sometimes is really, really difficult and really, really lonely. And then the third thing up here is that it's just full of steps and missteps. I would like to report to you that 21 years into marriage, our marriage has been a steady progression of me being an idiot to me being really like on it now. I would love to say that. It would just be a lie. Because sometimes the journey is like, I've gotten better at some things, and then I find myself doing something or saying something. I'm like, dear Lord, am I 22 years old again? What is my problem? I'm a child, perpetually. Some of you have this experience that you've been in a season of incredible growth, right? And you feel like you're becoming, and you think you're becoming the best version of yourselves that you've ever been. Not that you've arrived, but you just have this idea like, this is good. And I can tell you that many of you in just a month are going to sit at a family Thanksgiving table and you're going to walk away from that experience and say, how did I revert to my 14-year-old self? My brother always brings out this side of me that no matter how evolved I become, I just go right back to it, right? And some of you have much fear and trembling about being with family because somehow getting together with family once a year isn't helping your self-improvement project or your project of being a spiritual person. It's full of steps and missteps. I love that in this narrative, Abraham makes the mistake of Sarai and all that in Egypt, and then fast forward a couple decades later, and he just does the same freaking thing again. Because I just read that, and I was like, of course he did, because that's what I do. The journey isn't like just straight line. The journey always looks like forward and back, forward and back, forward, up and down. Like, oh, we're 2 steps up the ladder, 1 step down. 3 steps up the ladder, 5 down. Life is chutes and ladders. I should have just coined that somewhere, right? It's all chutes and ladders. And I know this doesn't feel like it's true when you're playing it. Sometimes you actually do get to the top of that stupid, stupid game. I hate that game. There's no like clear, that and Candyland both are the worst. All right, sorry. Another sermon that I don't have time for. Am I already over time? Whoa, go faster. Next slide. So here's what we gain though, when we leave home. Is we gain real community. I know some of you find this nerdy, but I love the pictures of, for Lord of the Rings, the Fellowship of the Ring. These people that I've just met that we're gonna go on a journey together and we have something to accomplish together and the bonds that are formed in that place. I like to go to parties and parties are good and I like to celebrate, that's fine. But you don't really forge deep community at a party. You forge deep community when you cry together and you work together and you journey together and you figure out hard stuff together. Those are the kinds of people that you just build deep bonds and connections with. Stephen here? Steve, like the Honduras, right? Those are the people you get connected to. You go for a week and you sweat and I froze on my trip, but sweat and freeze and get rained on and get mad and frustrated with the project. And many of you, the relationships you have in this church were formed in Honduras. I admire so many of you, like the journeys that many of you have gone on together in this space that, hey, I was sitting at a breakfast table on Thursday morning with some guys that I'm journeying through a book together. And I just admire these guys because they're journeyers. They're people that want to be on a journey and it's really good. And then we all started sharing, like I think 3 of us started crying in the course of the morning about, hey, here's where my journey goes. And here's where it's been, and here's where it's dark, and just owning that. And man, you feel really connected in those spaces, right? Like, we connect over those things.
I think back to starting this church and the group of friends that started this church, and many of them have moved away or left or all that now, but there was something that was formed in us because we started this church together. When you go on the journey, you will find your people. You'll find your tribe. There's something about being journeyers out there together, and that we grow together in this. Next one. We also, let me read this. So Brene Brown says, so in that community, we develop trust. So she says, the definition of trust that best aligns with my data comes from Charles Feltman. Feltman describes trust as choosing to risk making something you value vulnerable to another person's actions. Choosing to risk making something you value vulnerable to another person's actions. And he describes distrust as deciding that what is important to me is not safe with this person in this situation or any situation. Listen, the community that you'll find on the road, the community that you'll find in your spiritual journey, is the kinds of people that you can trust them to be vulnerable with, and that you're not holding things back, that what I say is safe with this person, that we can do this together, and I know that you'll help me through it. Now, I know that some of you, we've been in these spaces together, and I can look around the room and say, we've been in this space together, and it's challenging, and sometimes we don't always know what to do, and I want to give you one more quote from her book, and then I'm going to stop because I could just keep quoting her all day. She says, sometimes when we can't acknowledge the pain of others while experiencing our own joy, we close our eyes, insulate others, pretend there's nothing we can do to make things better, and opt out of helping others. This ability to opt out of suffering and injustice or pretend everything is okay is the core of privilege. I know that's a loaded word today in our culture, but I love this definition, and I want to circle back to it in just a second. Today, I choose not to acknowledge what's happening around me because it's too hard. The goal is to get to the place where we can think, I am aware of what's happening, the part I play, and how I can make it better, and that doesn't mean I have to deny the joy in my life. Can I take you back to last Monday? The reason that I said yes when Marvin called me and said, will you go talk to the school administration, is because it's too easy as a white person in that situation to say, it's not my problem. And to just go on with my day like it's no big deal because it doesn't really affect me. And that what she's calling us to is to engage in it and to say, listen, I'm going to show up there just because my friend Marvin asked me to show up and I love him and I believe that I just show up. I'm aware of what's happening. I'm aware of the part I play. I know what I can do to make it better. I keep responding to yes, I'm doing that. And it doesn't mean I have to deny the joy in my own life. I can do both of those at the same time. That's what this community does for us. I could spend a whole lot of time on that, but let's just keep going. All right, so the other thing, real quick, and I'll finish up. What we gain when we leave home is we come to understand that the journey is just greater than the destination. That there really is no real promised land. Israel got to the promised land and it wasn't as great as they thought. Led to a lot of wars and a lot of stuff, and then they eventually went into exile, and it was just never, the promised land was never really a thing. The journey is the thing. And we get little promised lands along the way. We get little vistas, we get little spots where we feel like, oh, this is clarity. Like, oh, this is a good space right here. But there'll come a time where we have to leave that space too. And we have to go on again. And there's never a spot where we just get to set up tent and be like, that's it, I'm here, I have arrived. That's just not a thing. It's not a place. It's not the journey that I think God is always calling us onto. It's always to keep calling us forward, to keep calling us out of our safety and out of our comfort. And then finally what we gain, and this is the last thing, is we gain a truer sense of our authentic self. That when we choose to leave the comforts and the sloth and the fears behind, and we go on hard journeys, and even when they're lonely and we find our new community, when we do all that, we find the self that God made us to be. The language we use in spirituality that we use in our formation communities is find our true self. Not the self I'm pretending to be, not the self that everybody else wants me to be, but really I just find the me that God created me to be. And that's never a one and done. That's never just do it once and you got it. That's always a continual process. This writer I really like, I've referred to the happiness advantage in here, and I just love this. He says, happiness is the joy we feel in striving after our human potential. And I would only tweak it in our context to say happiness is the joy we feel
in striving after becoming what God made us to become. It's the same thing, right? That's where joy is. Joy is in that space when I find myself striving after becoming fully who God gave me to be and not giving myself over just to my comfort and my fears and sloth and whatever else that keeps me from the journey, but giving myself to the journey. And so what I want you to do today is this. When you leave here, the conversation I hope that you'll have with your spouse or your small group or your spiritual guides or your friends or whoever it is that you have conversation with, even if they're not here, is to ask them what journey that they're on. What's the journey that you're on right now? I think you'll be fascinated to hear the answers to this. That across this room, I look across the room and I know lots of people and I know the journey that they're on. That, wow, that's a pretty incredible journey. And some of us, it's a very internal thing. Some of us is a little more external. Some of us, it's something that we've been keeping at bay for a long time and we finally just gotten the courage to go. I think one of the things I love about this space is there's a lot of people really that believe this message. This feels like preaching to the choir, right? That this message, that spirituality is a journey, that you're on it. The Apostle Paul talks about what the church is about is spurring each other on to love and good works. And I hope that we can be that space, that we can be that community for people, for each other, that says, hey, you're on a journey. Here's how I can help. Here's what I can do. And so maybe today, tomorrow, or next week, whatever, maybe just get curious about the people in your life and the journey that they're on. You'll be surprised what you find. You know what happens, just a real last flash in my head. You know what happens is when we get vulnerable and we share that journey, we empower others to go on the same journey. I was talking to a friend of mine this week and I was sharing with her part of my journey and she's like, you know what? After just talking to you, I have to take this step. And then a little bit later, I got a text and getting some qualifying like, hey, where did you find blah, 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 blah. And I was like, wow, I wasn't going to share that. And I did. And I'm glad it empowered somebody to take a step. And so sometimes just by doing that, by being brave and saying the journey that we're on, we empower somebody else. And it's just kind of this really, when a church is really functioning in that way, it's this really cool circular community where we're sharing and we're inspiring. And then we take a step and it inspires somebody else. And they take a step and inspire somebody else in a different kind of way. And it becomes just this really synergetic, awesome space. Let's pray. Oh God, I'm way over time. But this is just so deep in me. And I think this is so deep in the story of Israel and the story of faith and spirituality that this is just so, this is the thing. And so help us to be a place that's on a journey. Help us to be people that are on a journey and then a community that encourages journey, that pushes and helps and inspires and holds that space for each other. In your name I pray. Amen.